Okay, good afternoon, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Independent Research Forum's inaugural training and investor education event. My name is Jonathan Tice. I will be spearheading this new initiative and will be moderating the event today. So again, welcome and thank you very much for your time. An early word of warning, I will be talking about three Jonathans, which is quite unusual, three Jonathans in the same event. Myself, Jonathan Wilmot, one of our three esteemed speakers, and also Jonathan Evans, who, if you have feedback, if you need help during the call, if you want to get in touch afterwards, he works with IRF and would be a very good place to start, or myself. So today we are launching this initiative with a debate about inflation, a debate that's been going on for a long time now, but is just as relevant. And I think if I was back on the buy side or the sell side, we would be spending an awful lot of time still watching the data, trying to figure out what it was telling us, what it was telling us about how to position ourselves, etc. So, yes, it's been running as a debate for a long time, but it is at least as relevant now as it has been for a very long time. Before we launch into the speakers, just a little bit about what we're trying to achieve with the Training and Investor Education Service. Having joined and started working with Ed Ladd and the team a few months back, it struck me that IRF's in a pretty unique position with more than 330 providers of research, very smart people across a lot of asset classes. And so, what we can do is put together timely apposite events, debates, if you will, with smart researchers and smart thought leaders. Talking through how to think about things that matter for the market going forward. And this is clearly a very good topic, inflation, but we will be launching a number of other events in coming months, including how do you actually use AI in your screening and stock selection process? ESG, greenwashing or not? Well, no. And actually, it's relevant now. How do you think about it? Where does it matter? There's a lot of topics we've already got on the agenda. And one thing that I'd like to stress is this is our first event. We would love feedback. We want these to be as useful as possible. So please, if you have ideas, if you have feedback, do get in touch afterwards. The way we're approaching the training and education is effectively sort of two ways. On the one side, we've got what we are calling our topical and thematic events, like today, the what ifs, where we're looking to stoke investment debate. We're looking to get something that's timely and get three, four speakers sometimes who are experts in their field to articulate how to think about it, what you need to be thinking about, and depending on your view, how you need to position yourself. So being timely and relevant is very important. The second form of education, the more training based, is going to be a lot more technical, with tangible skill sets and insights from leading experts. And our goal here is to provide access to people with tools, in some cases like the AI event, actual tools that will help you generate alpha. Or if it's accounting, I mean, I'm a banking expert. Sadly, I know a lot about IFRS 9. But for tech, for example, we know that there are a lot of accounting vagaries with revenue recognition or again, the ESG side. So this is what we're looking to build out over the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months. I've had a lot of phone calls with a lot of the providers, and I have to say I'm very impressed with the quality. So I'm looking forward to hopefully talking to you guys again in future events. But please do give us feedback. Let us know what you think's interesting, what works, what doesn't. So a couple of housekeeping details. So we've got three speakers today. In terms of how we want to approach questions, you can put questions on the screen, the Q&A, and we'll get through as many as we can. Any that we can't get through, we will connect you with whoever the question was for afterwards via email or, if you wish, via a quick call. We're also going to run a poll because we're interested to find out whether or not this event changes your view and also what your view is. So if you could please take time, the first poll will be up fairly shortly on your screen, and then the second poll at the end. Poll, sorry, just to round out the event. Again, feedback, suggestions would be great. And to that end, the running order will be Chris Wapling, Manoj Pradhan, and Jonathan Wilmot. I won't read through the slide. You've all seen the flyer, but it's still very timely, and I'm looking forward to hearing what the speakers have to say. So, Chris, over to you.
Thanks very much, Jonathan, and great to be involved. I appreciate it. Great to be here. I mean, Longview Economics, as for those that don't know, is essentially a 20-year-old independent research house that's designed to basically connect macro to asset allocation and trading outcomes across global assets. And I'm going to argue about inflation and why I think it's going to surprise to the downside, which of course was what it did last year. And of course, what it's not doing at the moment. If we push forward to one slide, Wall Street, of course, the Economist consensus, investors are very much of the view that inflation's a little bit sticky at the moment. There's a sticky bias out there. The idea that getting down to the last 2%, the last 1 percentage point fall are the hard yards. And that stickiness, that argument for stickiness that you hear out there, has come from all sorts of angles. One of them, you can see a couple of charts on the right-hand side, a little bit of a bid in some of the survey data, whether it's the NFIB small business pricing plans. Of course, that accounts for quite a lot of the business output in the US economy, or ISM prices paid indices. You can see they've been bid up a little bit in the last few months. Certainly, albeit NFIB was a bit softer earlier this week. So that's driving this idea of sticky, the idea that financial conditions have loosened. That's going to deliver a little bit more growth this year. That's driving the idea of sticky. And of course, the idea that labor markets are tight is driving that idea that it's sticky. But my first point over the slide, next slide, please. My first point would be we've got to be humble. We've got to be humble about inflation. I mean, understanding what really drives inflation is far more complex than people realize. In fact, Janet Yellen here herself, as Fed chair in 2017, essentially in a speech saying that the Fed doesn't really understand the fundamental forces driving inflation. So that's where we're coming from. And then, that was compounded by Daniel Tarullo, who was the lawyer on the Fed committee from sort of 2010 to 2017. He was the regulatory guy, came onto the committee believing that the PhDs at the Fed were geniuses and the models were fantastic, left the committee in 2017, then gave this speech that I've quoted here, which basically says, to summarize, when he turned up at the Fed, he thought that the models were brilliant and the PhD economists were geniuses. By the time he left, he realized that the models didn't work. The PhD economists realized they didn't work, but they still use them anyway. So that's what we're dealing with. I mean, this is an extraordinary background for the most powerful institution probably in the world. And that's where we're coming from. So what I wanted to do, just to crack on to the next slide, please, Jonathan, thank you, is really talk about five reasons that I don't think inflation's sticky. I think it's trending down and I think it's under control. That's my first, oh, that wasn't, I thought I got stuck there. So that's my first point. Then I want to crack into what I think is more important in these markets, actually, that actually there's a liquidity risk coming up. And then we're going to touch on valuation very, very quickly and talk about some tactical views on equity markets. So I'm kind of interested. We forecast markets on a tactical basis, which I think of as a few months, and we also forecast them on a strategic basis. So let me start with the inflation. So let's kick into the five reasons. So firstly, I think Jonathan Tice, may I, am I having internet problems here, or am I stuttering? No? Okay, good. Thank you. So here's my first point. This isn't the 1970s. I think there's an anchoring effect out there amongst economists in that we've had a surge in inflation in the last 12, 18 months. And kind of if you look backwards, the last really big surge was the 70s. You can argue there was a little bit in the 1990s at the beginning, but really it's the 1970s. And people sort of anchor on that. And you get these comments that the last bit's the hard yard. And then you look at this chart on the right-hand side, you can see it comes off and then it doesn't quite get back to that two-ish level and resurges again and does that a couple of times. You get a couple of waves in the 1970s. So I think that's part of why people see it as sticky. But as I say, I think there are three reasons why it's not the 1970s. Number one, the approach to monetary policy is completely different. I mean, I think it's well known in markets now that Arthur Burns, who was the Fed chair in the 1970s, didn't really believe you could control inflation and certainly wasn't into controlling the money supply in a big way. And of course, Jerome Powell is very much a different beast, and he's been very aggressive in jacking up rates in the last 18 months. And money supply is now contracting. And I'll show you in a chart in a minute that shows the contrast of the 70s on that. So that's point number one, different Fed chair, different approach to monetary policy. Secondly, in the 1970s, there was a lot of phases of price controls. Nixon put them on, took them off. Ford did the same. And throughout the decade, you had this wave of price controls on, price controls off, influencing inflation and allowing it to surge and then putting a cap on it and so on. So, of course, we don't have any of that today. So that's the second key difference. And then I think the third key difference is today's we have baby boomers retiring, leaving the workforce and aging and getting into their retirement years when they don't tend to be very inflationary in their spending trends. In the 1970s, those very same baby boomers were going into the workforce, forming households, having babies, borrowing money, spending a lot of money, et cetera, et cetera. So for those three key reasons, this is not the 1970s. That's point number one. Point number two over the page is the monetary aspect is very different today. So if you look at the surge in M2 here in 2020 is the red line with M2 surging up to over 20% year on year, almost 25%. The parallel is not with the 1970s. It is with the sort of pre-1950s surges, where M2 surges and then it comes off fast and CPI follows. The 1970s, in fact, very different. As you can see, money supply growth is high for a prolonged period of time throughout the decade, and it never really gets back to zero. It certainly doesn't go anywhere near negative territory. So the pattern in the last couple of years looks just like it did pre-1950. So I think when you think about inflation in the last few years, to me, I'm not a monetarist, I'm not a Keynesian, I think they're all interesting. This pattern looks much more like monetary inflation than at any other time, certainly in my working career. So the fact that money supply is now contracting, as you can, well, no, you can't see that over the page. I took that slide out. But the fact that money supply is contracting should lead to inflation to dissipate faster than people expect, which is what it was doing last year. And the third thing I would say is, you know, back to the point about Jerome Powell being quite aggressive, there's plenty of economic evidence that actually money's really pretty tight. And the most obvious place to see that is credit growth around the West and or housing activity. All the sort of housing activity charts are pretty much on the floor. Most of the credit growth charts are pretty much on the floor. And there's a couple of examples of these kind of charts here. Net mortgage lending in the UK is negative for most of the last year. In other words, the UK mortgage book is actually shrinking. You know, same point in France. The mortgage book is shrinking. You can see it for the Eurozone as a whole there. And the same sort of factors at play in the States. Housing activity on the floor at pre-GFC levels or lower. Credit growth not really doing much at all over in the States as well. And in fact, if we flip over the page again, you'll see there's a very good correlation, I think. Doesn't look quite as good because of the surge of inflation in the last 12 months has distorted, the last 2 years has distorted the scale. But basically, there's pretty good correlation between bank lending growth and CPI, core CPI. And of course, that's very logical. You know, more bank lending, more economic activity, more inflation because there's more demand. So for that reason, monetary growth is negative. It looks like a monetary surge of inflation, and now growth is contracting. That suggests that inflation should dissipate faster. But even if you're not into that, and like many central bankers, perhaps you're into inflation expectations, if you look at all the inflation expectations charts around the sort of West, and here's Michigan 1 year ahead in this chart, they're back in normal territory. New York Fed inflation expectations, pretty much back where it should be. Michigan 5 year a little bit toppy, but not so bad. So, I think even if you look at inflation expectations, you don't need to worry too much. And then I think the other approach to inflation, and what I'm trying to do, is cover really all inflation bases, if you like, very quickly. But of course, the other one that central banks like, and a lot of these econometric models like, is the idea that the Phillips curve is critical. And I mentioned at the start, part of the reason inflation's seen as sticky is because there's a view that the labor market's too tight and growth's re-accelerating, and therefore we're going to get some pickup in core CPI because wage inflation will feed into that service sector inflation side of the economy. But just like I said, and the reason Janet Yellen concluded in that quote earlier that the Fed fundamentally probably doesn't understand the forces driving inflation, the reason she concluded that was because this chart on the left-hand side, the Phillips curve relationship is by no means clearly working at all. I would argue quite the reverse. There's pretty much no clear relationship between the unemployment rate and wage inflation. And there's no clear relationship between the unemployment rate and core CPI. In fact, this chart on the left-hand side, you can see that a core CPI in September of 2022 was running at 6.5%. Unemployment was about 3.5%. And now core CPI is down, 3.5%, 4-ish, and unemployment is basically at the same rate. In other words, there's no correlation whatsoever. As the Phillips curve would predict, core CPI is coming down, unemployment rate's not really moving that much. And to be honest, each of the colored periods is one economic cycle in the last 3 or 4 decades. And most of the time it's flat as a pancake. But even if you think it is about the Phillips curve, you can look at the right-hand chart, which tells you that unit labor costs are basically zero. In other words, businesses are absorbing any wage inflation that's out there because productivity is surging. So from that perspective, I don't think we need to worry about inflation. And then finally, what I'd say is if you, on the next slide, yeah, thank you. If you drill down into the models, you can see that, median inflation on an annual basis. So the left-hand one is year on year, not month on month. And the right-hand one is month on month, not year on year. But if you drill down into these, you can see that other than January this year, where the month on month perked up, basically the monthly median inflation is in the ballpark of normal, and the annual one has come down pretty rapidly. So on the inflation side, what I'd say is I think you can look across a breadth of inflation theories. And I think other than the fact that we've got a little bit of perkiness in a couple of survey data points, I don't think there's any evidence that inflation's sticky. It looks like monetary inflation to me in the last couple of years, and I think it's going to keep coming off pretty fast. So that leads me to what I think is a much more important point for asset allocation, which is what about the market liquidity risk? That is the challenge, I think, of the next 6 months. Because if I look at the stock market over the last 12, 15 years post GFC, the most obvious marginal driver has been net new market liquidity, measured here as sort of QE or QT, less US Treasury issuance. And up until really 12, 18 months ago, this correlation worked pretty well. And in a sense, it's no more complicated than saying when the Fed does QT, the PE ratio expands. When it stops and slows QE, sorry, when the Fed does QE, the PE ratio expands. When it stops or slows QE, the PE ratio starts to contract, and that's exacerbated if they start QT. That's net new marginal liquidity driving assets, driving equities, and so on. And the Treasury issuance part is basically the idea of when the Treasury is issuing a ton of debt, if it's not doing QE, it's sucking liquidity out of markets. There's less left for equities, and therefore equities struggle. So the key point here is we're talking about marginal new liquidity. There's tons of other liquidity that's constantly coming into the market and always will be. But at the margin, this is really what's been driving the main factors here. And if we just stay on that model, if you just go back a slide, sorry. The important point is in the last 12, 15 months, this model's broken down. And the model's broken down because there have been three pandemic emergency liquidity programs that have been still running in the background. The Bank Term Funding Premium, which is now finished as of a few weeks ago. You've had issues, the TGAs over time in the last 12, 18 months have been providing a lot of liquidity. And then finally, we've had the RRP probability pretty much on a constant basis on the last 7 or 8 months. Now, all those three programs have largely got to a conclusion. And therefore, if you go back a page, the correlation that you see here, I think, is going to reassert itself. And I think, therefore, it's very important what the Fed says and does about QT and how much debt the US Treasury has to issue over the next 3 to 6 months, because that will determine the net new marginal liquidity going into the market. And it looks to me like the Fed's backing off from the idea of quickly finishing QT, and looks like it's going to be lingering a bit, given the comments we've had out of the Fed in the last 4 to 6 weeks, which I think makes the liquidity environment very difficult for the second and third quarter. And this is something we've been writing about quite a lot in the last few months. So when you wind forwards and you think about the valuation in the market, and you think about the potential valuation risk, there are some challenges. The first thing I would say, though, before we talk about that, is don't get me wrong, I don't think valuation is a great market timing tool. It's a very poor market timing tool. It generally doesn't work on a 1 year basis, a 3 year basis, and even sometimes on a 5 year basis. Extreme relative valuations, interesting. Extreme valuations, interesting. But again, don't be sucked in and use them as a market timing tool. But what they do is they tell you about how vulnerable the market is. And if we look at the next slide, we can see that actually the US equity market's become very richly priced, and therefore has become really quite vulnerable to this liquidity event. So if you just switch on to the next slide, Jonathan. Thank you. And there are lots of ways of showing this. This is just a couple of charts that illustrate. If you look at the US equity risk premium, it's now running at under 3% on the left-hand chart, having run at about 5% or 6% for the prior 10 years. And really, under 3%, it never goes to, except in the TMT bubble, and very occasionally over the last 50 years, very rare. So it's, in other words, a very richly priced market on an equity risk premium. If you looked at a forward P/E ratio, it's 20.8 times forward rolling 12-month consensus earnings. Only been more expensive in the pandemic liquidity years and the TMT bubble. In other words, very richly priced. And same point here on the Shiller P/E ratio. So my point is, the market is vulnerable because it's expensive, and it's faced with this liquidity event coming up, which I think could be the trigger. That means that you start to get that market pullback. But most importantly, over the next slide, what we like to do in the last couple of minutes, I'll explain, is really look at where the tactical models are positioned. Because this is the major piece of the tactical pie. As I said, we like to do tactical asset allocation and strategic asset allocation. And the tactical month-by-month stuff, what really matters is what the models are saying. And as you can see, over the last sort of 6, 7 months, we tilted from underweight as we came into October, tilted it to an overweight position throughout October, and we've been overweight on a tactical basis since that October switch from under to overweight, and we remain overweight. But what we're starting to worry about is some of the models. So what you'll see on the next slide is, if you look at sentiment scoring system or the right-hand market environment scoring system, both of them are starting to generate sell signals. So there's a bit of a troubling background message. These models are not often very good at timing markets on a month-by-month basis. Sentiment can be several months early, particularly in strong bull markets. Equally, over the page, same point about technical models. They work very well in the last few years, but in this market, where it's a surging strong bull market, you don't want to be too quick to sell out just because they're technically overbought. And then what I would say is, what's getting more interesting, as you flip onto the next slide, you'll see that if you start looking at markets from a single stock basis, there's still some opportunity in them. There's a bit of opportunity in this model on the right-hand side, which aggregates all single stock RSIs. The one on the left-hand side is starting to get toppy, but again, can be a little bit early. And what we're really waiting for is what we see on the last slide. Markets sell off because they've become excessively greedy for risk. And this model on the left-hand side is a very good model for measuring when markets have got to that state of play. In other words, you've had persistent greediness. You get that where this sell-off indicator on the left-hand side delivers a plus 20. It doesn't, you know, it does it fairly regularly, a couple of times a year. You can see it's done it in quite a timely fashion over the course of the last couple of years, as this chart shows. And what's interesting about it at the moment is it hasn't generated a signal. It hasn't reached that key plus 20 level once since this rally began in October. In other words, the model's telling you by sucking information out of global financial markets on a daily basis, it's telling you the market is not excessively greedy at this stage. It's a very orderly bull market in many ways, and it's doing exactly what it should be doing. And until we get a signal from this model, we're unlikely to start checking out of that tactical overweight position. Now, that model and other sort of risk appetite models that we've been running for 20 years or so are critical, I think. And I think there's a sort of piece of the pie we want to see start ticking boxes, getting to sell along with that liquidity story, at which stage we start to get slightly concerned about the tactical backdrop for equity markets. Now, where does that leave us in terms of bonds? You know, we could spend hours debating term premia. My time is literally almost up, so I don't have time to dig into that. But what I would say is a fair value for US 10-year Treasury yields on the prior slide, sorry. On the prior slide, the fair value for 10-year Treasury yields, you'll see at the top right, we estimate is about 3.5% yield. Equally, you could look at some scenarios in the bottom right-hand side that if I'm right and inflation keeps coming down, break-even inflation rates come down, and growth softens, so tip yields come off a little bit, again, you know, bonds look attractive here. Now, obviously, of course, also, if I'm right and you get equity markets selling off in the middle of this year into the summer months, then again, bonds are probably attractive. So I think from a tactical perspective, you want to be long. To conclude, you want to be long tactically for now. We're waiting for those models. We think inflation is licked, so that adds grist to the mill as reasons to buy bonds. And of course, the fair value of bonds is lower. And if equities really do sell off over the course of the summer, that'll reinforce the position in being long and overweight bonds as well. So for me, I think inflation's done. The implications for asset allocation are that on a tactical basis. Obviously, on a strategic longer term basis, it might be a slightly different approach that we would take. But that, I think, is my 22 minutes. Not too bad, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Chris. Very interesting. Yeah, we will have to move on. I'll ask a couple of questions. Thank you for the questions so far. And again, please don't forget the polls and put your questions in. The first question, and one that would be probably one I'd ask, what's the biggest risk, do you think, to your thesis?
Well, the biggest risk is clearly that I'm wrong on the stickiness of inflation. You know that, and you know, going back to Janet Yellen's comment that even the Fed doesn't feel they properly understand the fundamental factors that drive inflation. That is clearly a significant risk. I mean, it could also be the case that inflation actually surprises further to the downside than I expect, and actually has a bit of a squeeze on corporate margins and revenues as a result, and therefore you get some stock market implications from that. So I think there are two-way risks on that, and I'd summarize them quickly as that.
Sure. Well, I have a question. In terms of Magnificent Seven and the way you're backing out equity risk premium, et cetera, how easy is it to strip that out? And how comfortable are you that bar seven stocks, the correlations are perhaps different from the charts that you showed?
Well, I think if I look at the valuation setup, it's very, very similar in all sorts of ways to 2000. I mean, there are a few international differences, but the concentration risk has a lot of parallels. Tech is not as expensive as it was in 2000 relative to the market, but it is very expensive. You know, 10 stocks are now 14% of global market cap. They were 11% of global market cap in 2000. So there are a lot of parallels. So I like to think about markets in the whole. The Magnificent Seven is a distribution call within the market, not for the market as a whole. And I suspect in the second half of this year, when we start getting rate cuts and more liquidity, you'll get a broadening of participation in this stock market, and therefore an underperformance of the Magnificent Seven.
Thank you ever so much for that. Very interesting. And again, please do keep the questions coming. We will connect you after the event if we haven't managed to get through the questions. Moving on, Manoj, very pleased to welcome you. Please introduce yourself.
Well, thanks for having me here. Thanks everyone for being here. I'm representing Talking Heads Macroeconomics. It's a firm that we founded in 2016. I work very closely with Charles Goodhart. And our general strategy has been to look at matters on a global basis, on a general equilibrium basis, and to try and bring a healthy mix of academic-ish thinking to try and get a general sense of where the global macro economy is going and what it means for the short to medium term for markets. On top of that, what we try to do is overlay I think, a fairly interesting structure for looking at the way fundamentals influence macroeconomics. If anyone's interested, I'd be very happy to chat over that on a call. And broadly, what I wanted to present over here today is two things that I found really interesting from Chris's point of view. Number one is a medium-term story, where I think what we're looking at is more a change in the inflation regime. So the question of where inflation will go over 3 to 6 months is very important for markets, should be less important for central banks, because they want to look at it on a longer-term horizon. And once we get to a bottom in inflation, the question investors will want to ask is where next from here? And if we take the view that the next 3 months defines the next 2 years of inflation, I think we'd be very, very badly mistaken. Just as if we take the view that the next 2 years of inflation will define where the next 10 years of inflation will go, we'll be very mistaken then. So I want to build it up slowly from the near term and try and link in the next 6 to 12 months in what I'm going to present. And what I wanted to start with today is try and give you a sense of how we're looking at markets. But the starting point for that is what stage of the cycle are we in? And the stage of the cycle that we're in right now is one in which markets simply cannot see what the terminal rate is. They conflate terminal and neutral rates. The best that we're doing right now is trying to shift our thinking to where the interest rate can go because where is neutral? If you go to the next slide, what you'll see is that in many cases, the neutral interest rate, for good reasons or bad, has shifted up or down. So while markets are looking at terminal rates for the Fed, today's looks somewhat close to 365, 370 on the 2 year, 1 year, as where interest rates will go, that's not very different from where the market pricing of neutral is. So I generally try to think of, say, the 2 year, 1 year as the terminal rate that the markets have in mind, and the 5 year, 5 year as the equilibrium rate that markets have in mind. In most cases, those numbers are not very different, which goes to my point that, well, interestingly, what the market's thinking about is where we could go to neutral. But what's been more important is where has R star fallen or risen? And I think you want to make a distinction here between R star rising and falling in the short and the medium term. In the short term, anything that makes the economy less sensitive to monetary policy will be seen to be a shift upward in R star. Over a period of time, those factors could weed themselves out. For example, the simplest one that I'm going to spend a fair bit of time on today is the fiscal spread among economies in the world. If I look at the US economy, there's been a huge fiscal impulse. 10% primary deficit over the last year and this year is nothing to joke about, and that deficit number is not going to get much better. On the other hand, if I look at the euro area, Germany's got a German constitutional court constraint, which is almost forcing it to run austerity. We've seen what the budget in the UK has been, and the IFS and OBR reports on that show the amount of austerity that's in place for us. So in the US economy, you could almost see that fiscal policy is creating an offset to monetary policy, and therefore the impact of monetary policy is much lower. In the euro area, fiscal policy might even be reinforcing what monetary policy is doing, and the downside risk over there should be greater. As opposed to that, another point that Chris made, which I really liked, was what's happening on the side of the real economy. Again, in the US, there is no pressure on firms to lay off workers simply because productivity growth has been so strong. If I look in the UK, it's been flat. And if I look in the euro area, it has fallen over a period of time. Which means we then have to go to a third point, is to try and see where energy prices are doing more damage. This is not a simple comparison. If it was simple, none of us would be in these jobs. It's a really complex puzzle we're trying to weave. And the way I'm looking at it is there are certain economies with high R star and economies that give you very, very, very little room to start easing interest rates below neutral. And that's where we want to really figure out where interest rates will move. On my thinking, the Fed has to take terminal rates above neutral and keep them there. So I would say somewhere between 100 to 125 basis points of cuts based on something that looks like the mid-90s makes a lot of sense to me, because this soft landing, while we call it a soft landing, looks like the end of a cycle, but it's not. I think it's far more sensible to call it a mid-cycle slowdown. Against that, what that does for other economies that need lower interest rates is, with the notable exception this time of emerging markets, particularly LATAM, which were forced to hike interest rates, and C3 to a similar extent, the advanced economies have been held back from easing monetary policy in line with what their economies need, and will probably have to ease much, much more than anyone realizes at this point in time. The greatest risk reward, I think, over here comes from two economies, one probably the RBA. And the second one is the Riksbank, which is going through an old school housing market crisis. So, how do we think of this in terms of running trades or running equity or FX positions? Sorry, if we just stick to that one for just one more second, Jonathan. What we want to do over here is we want to try and think about a widening spread between payers and receivers. As long as the US economy is printing something close to a 4% in the 2 year, 1 year, there is no reason to pay interest rates over there. And we can start thinking about receiving in places that have greater downside. In the equity market, I feel there's a lot that depends on the state of the US economy that is already reflected in interest rates. So I've been far more willing to look at Japan and India, two places where the CapEx story is going great guns. I've been long Japan equities for more than a year, India equities for more than 6 months, and I think the election will be the pivotal story that happens in the next few months. And finally, on the FX side, there are smart ways to receive interest rates in high-yielding economies. The best performing one of the lot, which I really like, is MXN against JPY, because I don't think Mexico, like the US, will be able to ease interest rates below neutral. And if you want to take advantage of those yields, the best place to be is in FX. If you could skip two slides, I'll skip one in the interest of time. The point I want to make over here, I'm sorry the legends have gotten wiped out. That's my fault. So I'll read you through some of the lines over here. The red and the orange lines that you see on top over there are the yield curve. And the yield curve is essentially telling you that periods of inversion, which have been associated with recessions, don't always lead to a recession unless they're also accompanied by upward move in the blue line, which is the fiscal balance. And in the last couple of cycles, even though you have seen yield curves flattening or inverting, we have not seen a recession because the fiscal balance has offset monetary tightening. This is a story that goes all the way back to the 1960s. Estrella and Mishkin first in 1995 wrote this paper called The Yield Curve as a Predictor of US Recessions. But in that Probit model, they really didn't have a fiscal impulse either. So I feel that we are ignoring a period of expansionary fiscal policy, no matter who comes into the White House in the next cycle. And I feel it's still a 50-50, even though markets seem to have taken it for granted that Trump will be the new president. Even if Biden comes back or Trump comes back, it's I think a done deal. The fiscal policy stance will be very, very expansionary. It's just that the programs that they choose will be different, and that could have an impact on multipliers. If we move to the next slide gives you a feel about where fiscal policy is moving. So the chart on the left-hand side tells you a little bit about why the story has had protection from fiscal policy. We've had very, very strong employment, very few layoffs that Joel's give you details for. And if I look at the lower three lines on the left-hand side, those are the deposits into time deposits and retail money market mutual funds since the Fed started hiking interest rates. Each of those three lines has gone up by $1 trillion. So I'm a little bit nonplussed, I must say, about the calculation of savings in the US household. Lisa Cook was detailing in a speech that excess savings have really fallen. And that I understand comes from the calculation from the personal savings rate, which is now below its long-term average, and hence we think savings have gone off. But the hard numbers are telling you that U.S. households, the upper end of U.S. households, hold nearly $3 trillion of savings, have increased their holdings since the Fed started hiking interest rates. And on the right-hand side, those are the two stories that I think give you a little bit of an idea of where those numbers would have gone. So the personal savings rate is in blue, and the orange line is real disposable income, which has had a year-on-year decline in the last print. But real disposable income is running around 4% until this last print. And that number actually is more on the basis of inflation and base effects, while the actual level of real disposable income has stayed flat. And why is that important? Because real disposable income looks at non-wage compensation from interest rates, from profits, and it looked like direct transfers. So if you look at it from that point of view, you don't really have to worry about a significant decline in the purchasing power of consumers that's going to lead to a dramatic slowdown in the economy. If it happens, of course, we'll have to change our view on it. But nothing from the income side, nothing from the fiscal side tells you that there's any reason to panic about monetary tightening at this point in time. If you go to the next slide, you'll see that I'm sorry, somehow these slides have gotten their titles completely chopped off. And I don't know what the story is here. They should have all of their lines on there, but let me explain to you again what that is. These are US cycles, and this is real personal disposable income, which tells you that before you've had recessions in the past, before we had excess savings and before we had pandemic-related savings, most recessions got a signal from real personal disposable income, which showed a persistent downdraft. The latest number, as I told you, is more about base effects. But if that goes down to zero or below, that's when we should start worrying. This is not the time to start worrying right now. If you go to the next slide,
Amal, as well, I do that as well. Apologies for this. I'm going to see if I've got another copy of
okay,
this
I
because it
can
didn't
explain
look
it as we
very
go
good.
along. In the interest of time, I don't think we can fix it in this point at this point. But let's just move on. No worries. And so from this point of view, again, I think what we then have to look out for is what can break that cycle of consumption. At this point in time, I think the way you look at the US economy is that there have to be some reason for consumption to fall off. So either the personal disposable income and the savings of the relatively rich households takes a big hit, or firms decide to start laying off workers. And while you see some signals that the labor market is softening, the line in blue here, for many of you who are artistically inclined, is hours worked, which have gone down below the peak of the past cycles. And the orange line, which is quits, which has come down, but still near the peaks of the past cycle. Both of them are showing a slowing in the labor market. But remember that there is a massive nonlinear moment between the time people start using a little less by way of labor demand and outright chop payrolls. That moment is not upon us yet. We're quite a long ways away from there. And effectively speaking, if the productivity numbers are taken into account, there is neither pressure on firms, nor pressure on household incomes to really start retrenching workers and laying off people and creating something like a recession, which means a growth slowdown that would bring inflation down, particularly domestically generated, is not something we should be looking at. If you can go to the next slide. Sorry, let me walk you through this again. So the next slide is a, I think, an important thesis that central banks have gotten incredibly, incredibly wrong. I don't think they're wrong in the way they're interpreting this for households, but the way they're looking at inflation, I think, is just something that they're missing out completely on. So the orange line over here is US CPI, and the blue line that you've got is China PPI. And what that's telling you is that there is a two-way relationship. What you'll notice is that in times when there is a US recession, US CPI comes down because demand falls, and that clearly creates lower demand for Chinese production, and that brings China PPI down. But that period after the thick gray bar, which is the Great Financial Crisis, the aftermath of that in 2012-15 is when China had a problem at home. And at that point in time, China PPI came down, which the US dollar imported into its own inflation side of the story, and that brought goods inflation down, a picture that I'll get to. The point I'm trying to make over here is this is a second time that China has bailed out the world. The decline that you've seen in inflation in most countries has primarily come from goods disinflation, not from monetary tightening, right? And so from that perspective, whatever victory that central banks are declaring at home makes a lot of sense, because when you and I buy products, we don't really say that's Chinese made, that's Indian made, that's made in South Africa, this is made in the US. No, we just have a consumption basket that maximizes our utility. But when it comes to macroeconomics, central banks need to start looking at what effect monetary policy has had on domestically generated inflation. That was the cornerstone of the Fed's policy last year when they looked at super core inflation, which was services inflation ex energy. And that I thought was the right perspective. In February, Powell has walked away from that definition in a concerted manner, arguing that the composition of disinflation no longer matters. If you go to the next slide, you'll see why this is important. Good. So we've got all
Yeah,
of them here.
apologies, man. I was, but they appear to
It's
be
okay,
fast. I
Jonathan.
don't
Don't
know what
worry.
happened to
Happen
those.
at PowerPoint sometimes. It's just something that different versions don't interact with each other. But luckily, it's all good. So what I've done over here is taken core CPI, which is in blue, and split it into core services and core goods. And you see these two periods so clearly that it gives you a fantastic roadmap into looking into the future. So that pre-GFC period is absolutely incredible. What you see in there is that the red line, which is core goods deflation coming down, inflation coming down, comes from about 3% all the way down to minus 2%. That is a gigantic shift in the global aggregate supply curve. Fantastically benign, as we all know from Powell's speech, where you get better growth, you get lower inflation. And what that allows the services side to benefit from is an income and substitution effect, right? If a new household is going to buy a washing machine every day and the price of that washing machine falls, then there is more nominal and definitely real income left on the table for you to consume. And US households showed that by consuming services and keeping services inflation high. Post GFC, completely different. Numbers look somewhat similar, but the story is totally different. Post GFC, the US imports deflation out of very, very bad reasons, right? Europe goes into a crisis, China goes into secular stagnation. The real secular stagnation story, I feel, was in China, not in the United States. And emerging markets, the fragile five, as I used to call them in my old job, was essentially a deflationary story. So at that point in time, it's a huge leftward shift in the aggregate demand curve. And you can see that as not giving households any confidence in the US economy, and therefore services inflation is also at a lower level. So where does that leave us? This leaves us in a situation where the next few years will be decided by, number one, how strong you come out of this recession. A fantastic exit point, as I mentioned, for employment could be a very, very, very poor entry point for inflation. And number two, what happens in China is critical. So the current narrative about China's deflation and a massive structural change, I think, are stories that happened in 2012, 2015. China has created this housing market problem today in order to get rid of the housing market role that the Chinese economy has generally suffered from. This is not a global turn in deflation. If that story reverses, a little bit like we saw in the CPI print, where core goods inflation was 0.1 and not negative, we've got a reason to worry. And if you go to the next slide, I think the critical part is this one. So Kristen Forbes and Egerton both have had papers in which they have shown a nonlinear Phillips curve, a kinked Phillips curve, which shows that at tight labor market levels, inflation tends to go up. I refined that just a little bit on my chart on the right-hand side, and I tried to show you over there that domestically generated inflation, which is core services inflation, has a very strong relationship with tight labor markets. When the labor market is tight, regardless of what you have had in terms of inflation, we have seen a pickup in services inflation. Now, here's the problem. If we go on to the left-hand side, Charles Goodhart and I wrote a book in 2020 called The Great Demographic Reversal, in which we argued that the supply side, and particularly labor markets, are going to play a key role in determining inflation and real interest rates over the next few decades. And what we're seeing from here is that story being fast-tracked in the sense that in future cycles, as labor supply decreases, we will see tighter and tighter labor markets. And to loosen those labor markets, you'll have to create bigger and bigger output gaps. But if demography is going to lead to higher debt levels, creating large negative output gaps is going to give us a problem that we saw in the Truss administration about the sustainability of debt. So the central bank's ability to really push through disinflation on the services side is going to matter more at a time when the deflationary impulse from China is actually becoming a smaller tailwind for growth. I think in the next 3 to 6 months, we don't really have necessarily an inflation problem. I've been received almost all over the place, except for when central bank pricing for the Fed gets too excessively loose. And when we start talking about 4 and 5 cuts, that's not when I want to be received. That's when I want to be paid. But as we get to 2 to 3 cuts for priced in for this year, a 2 year, 1 year that comes close to 4%, I think the rest of the world receive makes sense. But I think the biggest mispricing in markets right now, and we'll see that over a period of time, is breakevens. 2.3% for breakeven inflation over the next decade, over 10 years, makes absolutely no sense to me. And I will end this discussion by arguing that inflation, if it shows up in the next cycle or after the soft landing or what I would call a mid-cycle slowdown, is a bigger problem for markets because right now we can look back and say, this was all the beverage curve, this was all the pandemic. But if it shows up again, that faith will be rocked to its core. And I think that's the point in time with which inflation premium will really get priced into the market. This looks like a slightly different cycle. That's an aberration. But if it happens again in the next cycle, it'll look like a change in an inflation regime. And I think that's what we should worry about. I'll stop it there. Thanks very much, Jonathan. Happy to take any questions if you've got them.
Yes, and again, apologies. And we do have the correct slides with the correct charts. So if people would like those afterwards, please let us know. I'll give you a couple of questions that we've had. Thank you. One's about the control that central bankers actually have over this environment, because clearly the world has changed dramatically from the 70s, 90s, etc. Can you just talk through how we should think about that?
Absolutely, Jonathan. And don't worry, this kind of stuff happens honestly with PowerPoint versions coming out every 3 days. I think we'll need AI to sort out the compatibility between PowerPoint regimes. So it's happened before, but thanks very much. I appreciate the effort. I would say that central banks actually never had as much control over inflation as they've asked us to believe or we've trusted them with. For example, one of the things, again, Charles and I outlined in the book is that the period over which we saw an incredible decline in disinflation and a very benign inflation regime, what Mervyn King called the nice years, non-inflationary constant expansion, really do look like a rightward shift in the global aggregate supply curve. And that's consistent with the baby boomers. That's consistent with China joining the global system. That's consistent with Eastern Europe opening up. And so, at the very least, I think we would have to argue that global demography helped pave the way for lower inflation. And if that's the case and global demography is reversing, we can't argue then that central banks suddenly now have more control. They had very benign tailwinds in the past, but right now what you're seeing is struggles against fiscal policy, struggles against administrations who see monetary policy as a hindrance to getting reelected, which was not the case in those decades prior to the GFC. And I think central banks have less control. They will have less control over inflation. And that's just something that we're going to have to get used to.
Sure. Again, we've got a couple of questions we can't get to, but one that I think is a very fair one. If the break-even rate 2.3 is wrong, what's the right number?
So there is a way to think about this. It's a longer answer, which Jonathan, I will pass on to you, and maybe you can pass on to the participants. I think the simple way to look at it is a change in heart that Larry Summers has had. His numbers, he gave a absolutely dramatic change in perspective the same week that SVB went down. So no one paid attention to it except the academic circles and central banking circles, which were rocked by his change in point of view. And his perspective on where neutral rates and inflation should be right now are very close to ours. So he argues, as Charles and I do, that neutral rates are probably closer to 1.5% as more demand becomes interest insensitive and supply shocks matter. He thinks that average inflation is probably 2.5%. Charles and I think it's probably 3%. And he thinks there's a tail risk of 4 to 5, whereas we think the risk is again of 4 to 5. So I would argue that 10-year in break-even inflation probably needs to be somewhere between 3 to 3.5%, and then we'd have to deal with real rates not climbing aggressively higher. So you'd be looking at 10-year bond yields of somewhere around 4% over a long run period. In other words, what we're trying to say is the way the interest rate market is shaped today is not abnormal. The way they were shaped over the last 30 or 35 years has been an aberration due to the demographic forces and what China had. What we're seeing now is a glimpse into a more normal future that we believe is simply a short interruption of a past trend. Actually, the past trend is an interruption of a longer period that we're going to go back to.
That's great. Thank you ever so much, Manoj.
Pleasure, Matt.
I will now hand over. But just before I do, again, we're looking for feedback, we're looking for questions. We will put the poll up while Jonathan's speaking, not because we want him to fill in before he's spoken, but to make sure that people don't forget. And without further ado, after two very interesting, different presentations, I'd like to introduce Jonathan Wilmot. Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good afternoon or good morning to everybody. I used to be the chief global strategist at Credit Suisse for about 30 years until I started my own firm 7 years ago with Dr. Eric Whitewood, who was the chief data scientist at Credit Suisse in London at the time. And what we do is we publish and sell macro strategy research to investors large and small around the world. And we also are starting to run external money with our systematic products based on our AI platform. I run with my own money a little macro hedge fund, and we might be opening that up to external investors later this year. So that's the background on me. Let me talk a little bit about on inflation and markets. Some overlap, some sympathy, some differences. One of the things that I've found over my very long career is that behind the data that we all, the macro data that we all watch and follow so carefully and try to interpret, there's usually a story or a set of stories which can provide signposts to the future, signposts to surprise, help us figure out why this cycle is different, and so on. And the simplest story that you can tell about the global economy right now has some echoes of the 1990s about it. But I think I'd put it this way: there's a huge contrast between what you would now call the new economy, which is largely booming, and the old economy, which is either muddling along or in stress or about to be in stress. And you see that contrast in as much in China as you do in the US. You see it to some extent in Europe too. And a lot of the mysteries that lie behind equity market performance are also kind of related to that. I'm going to show you a couple of slides about what's happening in China just to give you a flavor for what's going on there. We love to be gloomy about China and how awful the property market is, and the local authority debt, and so on, and all that is true, and all that is a big problem that's still in the process of being addressed or worked out. But actually, what President Xi has mandated is a great big push for technology and energy independence in China, and all the government money, subsidies, and incentives have been going towards chips, robots, and above all, clean energy, EVs, batteries, solar panels, wind turbines, and so on. And so you've had pretty average growth in industrial production over the year to January. You've had absolutely huge growth in solar cells, electric vehicles, power generating units, which includes wind turbines. And also though not shown here, within the chip space and on the robot side. So there is a major structural change. And in particular, China has cornered the market more or less in kind of producing low-cost solar panels, low-cost batteries and cheap EVs as a result of government help and subsidies, and now wants to export them around the world. And it pretty much has a lock on, or a partial lock on, many of the critical raw materials needed for the green transition. So China's version of fire and ice is massive contrast between that and anything that's to do with property and past leverage. And you can see a similar dichotomy in the US, where anything to do with AI and commercializing AI and building out the infrastructure that's going to be needed for AI in the future has gone absolutely ballistic since the arrival of ChatGPT just over a year ago, and all the generative AI models. And it's that sort of contrast within the economy that I think is actually really illuminating for both the inflation debate and thinking about the macro economy, and to some extent also about terminal rates, R-star, equilibrium real yields, and so on. If we just look for a moment at the next slide, the funny thing about this is that you've got some parts of the economy are booming and some parts of the economy are struggling. At the aggregate global level, you've got very slow growth, pretty miserable growth, maybe a little bit below trend growth. The US did accelerate last year. It's slowing now. And Europe's in a pretty sour place. Chinese growth has been underperforming. If you look at our measure of global industrial production against risk appetite, which we follow and forecast a lot, then it's not really going anywhere, despite recent hopes that there might be some revival in manufacturing. Our guess is it's not going to last. And so we have a global economy that's not doing particularly strongly, despite some parts of it being super, super hot. And that's because the new parts of it are small relative to the large parts. Let's think about inflation in that context, because, and maybe look at a couple of other slides. It seems to me that the simple takeaway from AI, but not just AI, but technological change and the interaction between AI and technological change. The arrival of generative AI is just one part of the AI transformation, but it will help to accelerate all the innovations that we need to solve the world's problems. And my guess is that the implications for US productivity are that we're going to see something like a replay of the mid-90s, which was the last time we were very bullish about productivity and the productivity S-curve. And what I've shown in this chart is output per hour for the private business sector. So, long-term trends about 2.5% per annum, 2% for the whole economy. And there have been long periods of alternating above trend and below trend periods of productivity growth, and I think we've just started a new period of above trend. Now, even I'm not a great fan of the idea that AGI is just around the corner. I'm not quite as bullish as some people are about productivity, but I see some very specific ways in which generative AI is being looked at, can be used, is being used, and is being used absolutely instantly without any kind of investment lag to improve productivity in services. And I think there are all sorts of other productivity potential benefits from new materials for smart manufacturing, for smart healthcare, and so on, which will come down the pipe. So I have a bullish view on productivity, and that has quite a lot of, it has implications for everything If we move on to the next slide, I just wanted to sort of, I mean, this is a suggestive chart rather than a kind of, if you like, serious analysis. This is a chart which shows the three very long cycles in US real equity returns that we have had since 1857. And if you take the average of the last two cycles and you put them up against the current one, which started in 1982, this is the story that you get. And the average of the last two cycles would suggest that we're on the threshold of a decent cyclical bear market. But at the same time, we haven't come to the end of the secular bull market, which started in 1982, which on these terms would have about another 7 years to run. I think this is actually quite a plausible framework. And so my thinking about this year is whether or not we are at risk, as I think Chris was highlighting, of actually having a relatively brief cyclical bear market, but still pretty painful before resuming the longer term bull trend. And then if we move on to the next slide, I want to stress that in principle, the shift to cleaner energy and the exploitation of AI and new technologies and that are partly enabled and sped up by it is a positive supply shock. It's probably going to be of the similar size to the positive supply shock that we had from incorporating cheap labor in Asia and elsewhere in the 1990s and beyond. There's still a bit of cheap labor to incorporate into the world economy. But if the story of the last couple of decades has been dominated by building or having a reserve army of labor, cheap labor, in the world economy, and especially in Asia, the story of the next 10 to 20 years will be building a reserve army of robots to replace them and replacing dirty and now and increasingly expensive fossil fuels with plentiful and much cheaper and less volatile eventually clean energy. So from my point of view, the whole driving force of the world economy is going to be very different over the next decade or so from what we had looking backwards. It will require a lot more investment, a lot more there's a lot of innovation, and there's a lot of obstacles to overcome. For example, regulatory obstacles and various other things to the deployment of cheap clean energy. But what you can see here on this particular slide is just how much China has pressed the pedal to the floor in terms of trying to install new capacity, solar and wind capacity increased by over 250 gigawatts last year. It's probably going to stay that way for a while because the aim is not really about climate change. It's fantastic news for climate change, but the aim is energy independence. And you can see a similar, not quite so dramatic trend in Europe, partly prompted by energy security concerns after the Ukraine war as well. The US is lagging way behind, and on our estimates, won't have enough electricity generation capacity to run all those AI models and electric cars in the future unless something changes in terms of investment and in new capacity. But what I think that means for inflation is the following, that somewhere in the long distant, in the far distant future, and I don't know how far distance exactly, we're going to have cheaper energy, probably cheaper food, cheaper healthcare, and we're going to have a much more close to home smart manufacturing system, which is much less geared towards China and the rest. And those changes are the things that are going to really drive the global economy going forward. And one final point about inflation. So I think I'm not quite as bullish as some people who say we're going to have a falling price boom because of the transitional issues of getting from here to there. But I think really controlling inflation on a permanent basis, keeping it down in the future at a reasonable sort of level of interest rates and employment is actually about these supply side changes, not so much about, and if you get them, you won't have to manage demand in the way that Manoush was worrying about earlier. Final point about inflation, next slide. The history of inflation in the United States, but also if you look back 600 or 700, 800 years and you include the history of Europe, it's really major shocks, upward shocks, persistent upward shocks to the price level that show up as inflation. They mostly take place during war periods. If you take out the impact of wars, you basically get 1 to 2% inflation. The normal sort of state of inflation in peacetime is kind of in the 0 to 2% per annum range, not anything like the 1970s and so on. So if you ask the questions about inflation structurally, I think we can look at the next slide. Can we build enough robots and solar? Well, probably, but it's going to take a lot of effort. Can we crack the storage problem for energy? I'm sort of guardedly optimistic about that, and certainly we can make a lot of progress in that direction. That's really crucial to the energy side of the equation. But can we avoid a major war is just as important. And I guess probably I think we can for the next 5 or 6 or 7 years. I'm not so sure about the end of President Xi's second term. So that's my sort of structural view. Let's have a look at the cycle story on inflation. We also use, like Chris does, some kind of PMI output price composite to look at as a pretty decent read, a better read than the inflation numbers themselves on where inflationary pressures are in the world economy. Basically, we're back in the normal territory, but tilting upwards just recently, as he pointed out. If you look at the next chart, you can see the NFIB wages story. You can see the composite PMI for output pricing, PMI for the United States. You can I'm just need to double check here. It is the 60/40. And then you can see what's actually happened to core inflation, core CPI in this case, less shelter, which is kind of in the right zone. If you look at the next chart, you can see what the Fed or some people at the Fed focus on again with the NFIB. And this is core inflation, core service sector inflation. And the reason it's doing that is mostly, well, it's partly because shelter inflation, at the aggregate levels, because shelter inflation remains pretty sticky, but that is going to come down. But in this case, when you've taken shelter inflation out, that looks like a worrying thing. Turns out that's mostly because of car insurance and car auto repair. Inflation has been absolutely stupendous over the last year, last 6 months, and it's still ongoing. And this is basically because of the shift to electric vehicles. Insurance companies are whacking up premiums to deal with the fact that every time an electric vehicle gets a tiny little knock, it gets written off because the battery might be damaged, and so on. This is not going to go on. It's not an indication that there is some kind of waiting demon of service sector inflation in the wings. So From my point of view, we've got inflation down. We have some reasons, which are really to do with productivity and potentially energy supply, for thinking that it would be easier to keep inflation down over the long run, but with a question mark over the transition. But as far as policy goes, it feels to me as though the Fed is going to do what it finds easy to do, which is always to be late, very late in this cycle, very late to start tightening, very late to start easing. Risk from the next meeting is that they're going to be thinking about only two rate cuts in the coming year. Now, bearing in mind all that, one of the implications of our productivity story and of the need to do a lot more investment to bring new supply into play is that we think equilibrium real bond yields are probably higher than they were before. We don't know how much higher, but probably higher. And we also think that it's likely that our star is a bit higher too, but not for the reasons that Larry Summers worries about particularly. It's more to do with the idea that nominal GDP growth is going to be on a higher trend than it was before, and that the economy may be more resilient than it was before to higher interest rates. Well, recently it's been very resilient to higher interest rates, somewhat of a surprise. That's partly because there's a lag between people needing to refinance mortgages or small business loans, or large business loans for that matter. It's partly also to do with fiscal policy, very importantly, to do with fiscal policy. All of these factors are less likely to be helpful in sustaining growth in the second half of the year and beyond. In fact, just by keeping rates where they are, our view is that rates, monetary policy is getting tighter. Equally, I think if the Fed doesn't shift its balance sheet policy, that plays into the sort of liquidity shock story that Chris was talking about. But what our version of US Taylor rule suggests, and there we've looked at hundreds of different specifications and played around with them, is that unless you have a very, very large permanent upward shift in R star, the Fed should have been cutting rates ages ago, should have started, and is not going to catch up with where rates should be probably until the end of 2025. And in that lies, in our view, potential risk to the real economy, despite some of the points that Manish was making earlier in the day. So if we just look at some a couple of things, there's one other reason which I think could help delay the Fed in terms of its plans to start cutting rates. Our view on China is that President Xi is not going to change his ultimate priorities. He's just trying to work out and prevent a big accident from happening to growth in terms of the property sector. He's not really interested in profits or private sector fortunes. He's interested in Communist Party control, and he's interested in independence, both technological and energy related. But the pressures on him are pretty intense in order to consolidate and maintain his grip on power to get rather better economic performance than we've had just recently. I think there will be a bit more stimulus. I think there will be a bit more activity, and most importantly, property investment and some of the property indicators that we follow are just probably beginning to bottom out. And so our view is that we're just seasonally in a period which is where demand for crude oil is very strong in the US for summer refining. It's very strong in China because most of their oil imports are concentrated into sort of the winter through to April, May. But we might have a little pop in oil prices, which is just going to make the Fed even more reluctant to cut when we think they should have been cutting ages ago. So we have a similar conclusion to Chris on the tactical asset allocation side. Yes, valuation measures are all our valuation measures basically say that equities are very, US equities are really overvalued against bonds. I'm not going to talk about these ones in the interests of time, but what I would say is that there's a little bit of ambiguity about what might be possible for the kind of level and growth rate of real earnings over the adoption of AI period. But what really matters for the stock market is the moment at which we start to see the momentum in the AI space, particularly, I mean, for Nvidia and all the related stocks that go with it. We're probably overinvesting in high-end chips right now or overbuying them. I kind of agree with Cathie Wood on this. In valuation terms, we would expect the revenge of bonds over equities at this point in time. It's our shorter-term indicators, including our AI models, don't tell us that you are there yet. But we're sort of looking for the trigger. It may be the Fed being too slow. It may be political risk that Trump introduces into the equation if it becomes more and more credible that he's going to be president and he follows the kind of policy path that he's been following during the primaries, which of course he may not. But we are basically looking for a prompt, as it were, for a fairly significant correction in equity markets and outperformance by bonds. But equally, we don't think the bonds are going back to the old trading range in real or in nominal terms. So we're a bit more skeptical about the idea that break-even inflation rates have to be a lot higher. We think that real yields, equilibrium real yields, are almost certainly higher. We don't know by exactly how much. And if I had to make a guess, I'd say somewhere between 3.5% and 5.5% could be the range for 30-year bond yields for quite some time to come going forward. It might just go a bit below that or a little bit above that in at cyclical extremes. So we're not talking about a return to the very low real and nominal yield environment that we had before, but we are positioned potentially for a cyclical move in favor of equities over bonds. So that's it from me, and I'll stop there.
Thank you ever so much, Jonathan. Just to remind everybody before I ask a couple of questions of him, please do fill in the poll that's on the screen. You can scroll down. I think there are seven questions. Very interested in the feedback. We'll be following up to find out what we should be doing next, etc. Jonathan, clearly your view on China, your discussion of the war, where are you on Europe? Because the UK, the US, China's been discussed quite a lot. Europe hasn't had as much discussion in today's webinar.
Yeah, no, I apologize for that. It's not that we don't cover Europe. In fact, we have my old colleague, Neville Hill, who used to be the chief European economist of Credit Suisse. He's advising us partly on Europe, partly on climate-related matters. And I've left it out only because the other stories are a bit clearer and easier to tell. There are really fascinating stories about Europe, but let me make that I could go into. Let me make 2 points, three very quick points. From a cyclical point of view, I do think Europe's a bit more vulnerable than the US. Fiscal policy, accumulated savings, and so on. But the big swing factor in Europe is what happens to natural gas prices. And if natural gas prices absolutely collapse back towards the levels that they were pre the Ukraine invasion, that's like a massive fiscal offset to the tighter fiscal policy that we see in Europe that Marash was talking about. I was sort of tentatively hopeful that that might happen this year after a mildish winter. There's plenty of inventory around, way more than normal. But I think there are a number of things that make me a little bit, a bit less optimistic about that. But in terms of disposable income growth and probably consumer confidence, spending on durables and so on, I think natural gas and electricity prices are the swing factor. And Europe is hugely geared because of the way energy markets work to natural gas and electricity prices in a way that the US is a little bit more vulnerable to oil prices. And taxes are so high on gasoline in Europe, it doesn't apply to Europe. And that's one point. The second point is that you do see pockets of incredible strength inside Europe where they are tied into the AI story, people like ASML and so on. But on the whole, Europe has less, fewer firms that are at the leading edge of the AI revolution, and that has made, had a big impact on returns. And third, where Europe is winning in a way is that I think they have a more credible plan for building out clean energy capacity faster than demand increases over the next decade or so than anybody else. And they'll use that to impose some kind of border carbon tax, which some people might see as protectionism, but which will alter the calculation on sort of competitiveness and so on. So that's the conclusion there is that, yes, I kind of agree the ECB's probably got to get on with cutting rates given current state of affairs, but unless natural gas prices come to the rescue.
Sure, that's great. Thank you. And you made a very compelling case for the positive supply shock. In terms of how you think about that, how you talk to investors about maximizing and playing that, where do you start?
Ah, okay. Well, it helps not to be macro. we've got a great well, we've got a connection with some very good tech analysts in Asia. I mean, it has been heavily concentrated in terms of the impact on equity markets. The AI shock has been heavily concentrated in hardware, and that is obviously and above all in turn it's Nvidia. Just the increase in expected earnings and the margins that Nvidia are making, just unbelievable. And that shock is the biggest single shock to expected earnings that I think I've ever seen for an individual company. But it's also true that US companies have lots of a stake in AI in various different ways, partly in through their cloud businesses, partly through Microsoft's investment in ChatGPT and all the rest. And as far as Tesla is concerned, as a car company, it's hurting, and it's really hurting as a result of primarily cheap competition from China, and that's going to continue. But its big trump card is whether it gets to kind of autonomous driving faster than anybody else, and it can commercialize that in a big way, and so on. So there are different individual stories where you have to, look at. And I mean, by the way, Apple is a bit of a victim of the trade war between China and so you kind of have to be more of a stock analyst than a macro person to really get this. On the whole, the way I think about this is to think first about the hardware cycle, and secondly about who benefits from design and of chips and the building out of data centers and for that matter electric vehicle charging stations and the rest. And then it's also about who benefits in terms of the applications of AI to businesses and whether that can improve their margins, control their costs, deal with labor shortages, and so on. And I think there's a whole lot of businesses. I mean, I would say financials are banks and so on are well placed. I think consulting companies are well placed to benefit and so on. But in terms of stock market now, it's largely about the software and cloud computing side of things. And it's when that momentum peaks that we'll maybe see some correction to the current set of the current enthusiasm in markets.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you ever so much, Jonathan. Thank you ever so much to all three of our speakers. Just to remind everybody, this was our first event of the new training and education program. We really do want ideas. We want feedback. IRF will be following up with those of you been on the call. We can provide the slides. If you'd like some follow-up questions, if you'd like a quick chat with any of the speakers, please let us know. We can arrange all of this. I personally, having worked in the markets for nearly 30 years, I've seldom had an hour and a half where I've kind of had that many things to think about, all of which are very pertinent and all of which spring from one simple word, inflation. So with that, I'll reiterate, please do the poll. Please give us feedback. And we look forward to being in touch with you soon. Thank you.